CliffCentral.com.
Our returning champion, Canthan Pillay, is here. The Birding Platform is brought to you by Nando's every single week, where we talk about all the stuff that's going on that you might be interested in. And if you want to contribute to any of this, then you get hold of us on 079-748-2090. We're joined also this morning by Dumo Denga, who is a master's in business science, a lover of philosophy, and the founder of the Man Patriot podcast. He's also a firm believer in free speech and free markets. So again, I don't know that he's going to be disagreeing too much with Canthan, but we will see.
Capitalism never sleeps.
That's true, and capitalists like to argue with each other.
Occasionally. Right. Well, at least we don't have a Zulu anarcho-capitalist this week.
That's true. All right, so Duma, nice to have you here.
Thanks, man. Thanks.
And thanks for joining us. First of all, let's start with the story that everybody is interested in. Just yesterday, President Cyril Ramaphosa at this Eskom, the power utility, the megawatt park, the head office, had an emergency press conference, and all of them were there. This guy called Jan Oberholzer, who is the COO of Eskom at the moment. What an awful job. And he was trying to give explanations as to which power stations are online, which ones aren't, which ones have been sabotaged, which ones haven't. Cyril says he flew back from Egypt in a panic. People said, you got to come back. The South African population is very, very angry with you. Pravin was there. They're all telling us that stage 6 load shedding was unexpected. It must have been the result of sabotage. And we are meant to swallow this in all its ugly entirety. The apparent problem the president was referring to was a problem that was dealt with, I think, 2.5 weeks ago, this issue of sabotage, and could not have been responsible for the load shedding, the stage 6 load shedding, which has caused all the outrage. But he wants us to believe this anyway. It turns out, after a little investigation, that was totally made up.
Made up?
Yeah.
Not surprised.
We had an Eskom engineer, I forget the name of the person, mm-hmm. who was saying, yes, it is true that there was an incident of sabotage, but it happened a week before
Correct.
The load shedding actually kicked in.
That's right. So there are a couple of people who are quite proficient in talking about things like this because they are engineers and they know engineers and they're very much involved.
So technically,
Ted Blom and Chris Yellen,
so, but technically
others.
Speaking, he's not lying. He's deflecting.
Okay, so in other words, Cyril flew back from Egypt to tell us a lie just to placate us.
Well, did it work?
No, clearly not, because people are still furious.
Yes, well, yeah.
All right. Well, first of all, did load shedding affect you guys? I mean, you know, you might live near a hospital. You might never be affected. You might be a government minister. You might never be affected. Certainly, I don't. They asked Pravin on ENCA if he'd ever been load shedding. He said, certainly, all the time. Do we believe him?
I do believe him.
You do?
But I don't believe people who live within the ministerial / ambassadorial district of Pretoria, because they never get load shedded.
Mm.
Yeah. Look, I kind of, you know, smiled through the entire thing, you know.
How do you smile? Teach the rest of us how.
Well, you might remember a while back I told you that I'd replaced all of the batteries in my UPSs.
Mm-hmm.
So basically when the power goes out at home, you know, I'm cooking with gas at any case, and all of my digital infrastructure keeps running happily because, you know, there's enough power to keep it running until the cycle actually ends.
So did this set you back quite a lot of money to set up your batteries and your UPS?
No, not exactly. Well, the ongoing maintenance, you know, every couple of years you spend, you know, the batteries are about 2,000 rand a piece.
Mm-hmm. So it's expensive, but it's still better than having to worry about interrupted power.
Well, yeah, because, you know, the big issue for me in terms of interrupted power is lack of connectivity.
Mm.
And, of course, what has been happening with the cell phone towers is that people have been stealing the batteries and generators from cell phone towers.
Right.
So when the lights go off, the cell phone towers don't keep going.
Right.
So, but fortunately, I've got fiber at home, mm-hmm. and so fiber doesn't go out with when the electricity goes out.
So you can continue to use your fiber.
So as long as I'm keeping my internal network up and running. And some years ago, I think it was probably close on 10 years now, when mm-hmm. I built a loft in my house, which basically is my office.
Mm-hmm.
And when I did so, I rewired it so that there were red plugs and white plugs.
Right, so your UPS plugs are the red ones.
The UPS plugs are the red ones. So okay. Basically all of my computer equipment and all of that stuff gets plugged into the red plugs. And they just go along quite happily.
They keep humming. So Dumo, you as a libertarian,
mm-hmm.
you must be pleased to hear things like this because you probably believe that we should be more independent of government and things like power and things like water and things like security and health insurance and all of that stuff should be up to the individual.
Yeah, definitely so.
I'm not putting words in your mouth, right?
No.
All right.
Definitely so. I think that listening to Canton's story, that's like aspirational for me and for many other libertarians out there.
No,
as
I'm
well.
Not there yet either, by the way. I have aspirations of having batteries and limited power supplies and all that kind of thing, but it's not.
I can hook something. You guys up for a small commission.
Please.
Yeah, we'll come to your house and just borrow off your red plugs if you don't mind.
Well, you know, people can, you know, come to my house and squat on my Wi-Fi in any case, and that's cool.
But let's just talk for a minute about Eskom, because mm-hmm. this is not something that's going to get better anytime soon. We heard yesterday from Ted Blom, who's an energy expert and analyst, and he has clients who he consults to about the power situation in South Africa. Eskom is a huge millstone around our necks, first of all, because they are dragging the economy down, and that is indisputable at this point. But if we are to get it right, and let's imagine government have every intention of getting it right, even if it's just because they want to carry on stealing, it's going to take 5 years. Can the economy bear that burden? Can South Africans, can business in this country bear that burden?
Yeah, for incumbents, maybe. Like with the big ones, because they have the funds to kind of avoid the negative effects of load shedding. Mm-hmm. It's like Canton's situation. So they already made plans to cater for that. But for new businesses, it's going to be incredibly difficult for them to do so because they depend on Eskom entirely. That's my view of it. But I don't for new businesses coming in, it's going to be incredibly difficult.
Well, the reason I raised this is because yesterday the ANC's NEC spoke out, and the Secretary General, Ace Magashule, had only a little bit to say. He basically said, we have noted what's going on. He didn't say that they're approving it. He didn't say that they've got any plans to accelerate improvements, to deal with the incompetencies, to sort out maintenance, nothing. The ANC's just noted this. It's like they've walked past someone who's begging on the street in rags and nodded their head. They've taken note. That's what they said. That's all Ace Magashule can tell us. He also had the same to say about SAA. They have noted that SAA has been put into business rescue.
And you're surprised for what reason?
Well,
look, I think what's more interesting is the stuff that Mabuza had to say over the past couple of days. I think he was speaking at an SACP meeting.
Yeah,
and he said that the decision to appoint the new CEO of Eskom was a decision taken by the ANC. So it wasn't actually taken by the minister, it wasn't actually taken by the president or by cabinet, but it was actually taken by the ANC, and that's why the masses should be giving their support to the new CEO of Eskom. So I suppose at that level one can take the view that the ANC is effectively taking collective responsibility for this, which effectively means that no specific person has responsibility for it.
So what happens when the ANC says collective responsibility is they manage to decentralize the blame.
Well, they also then trot out that tired narrative about all of us, private sector, public sector, and labor must work together.
Now, how do they want us to work together, do you think? Or do you think that's just a platitude?
I think it's a platitude.
Is Ace interested in Eskom working? Is Ace interested in SAA being put into business rescue? Do you think this keeps him up at night?
Nope.
Let's
play speculation.
I don't think it does. The way I see it is that I think what will keep Ace up at night is if these SOEs become privatized. As long as they're in the hands of the government, they don't care because, I mean, what do they have to lose?
So SAA being put into business rescue effectively means, in some ways, that there's only one person making the decisions now at SAA. So it's kind of scary in that respect because if that one person isn't someone who's genuinely interested in making this company right,
yeah,
they could do more damage than good.
Oh, I don't think so in SAS case. I think it's at the point right now where...
Couldn't get any worse?
It couldn't get any worse, not yeah. possibly.
All right.
Yeah. Look, let's just talk in terms of what the alternatives are in terms of ESCOM.
Mm-hmm.
And the big issue right now is the rollout of independent power producers, because effectively that's the only way we're going to fix this mess. Now, we've talked about the numbers that are involved in ESCOM in the past, where I basically said what one needs to do is to just simply reset that balance sheet effectively to zero so that we can actually start measuring ESCOM
mm-hmm.
without, you know, having to take into account all of the debt that's been piled up.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact is that you now have independent power producers who are coming in at a cost per megawatt that is cheaper than ESCOM is currently capable of producing. And they're very happy to start massive rollouts that now will feed that power into the grid. And the reason why the power is not being fed into the grid, the primary reason is that in order to produce electricity of more than 1 megawatt, you need a license from government.
Yeah, and so you have to ask permission.
You have to ask permission, and the person you have to ask permission for in this particular case is not Praveen. It's Gwede Mantashe in his capacity as Minister of Minerals and Energy Affairs.
Sure.
And there have been independent power producers that have been lined up waiting for these licenses to be released for more than 4 years.
And what's happening?
Nothing. So Mantashe has basically been sitting.
Are you telling me that these independent power producers could have assuaged the problem that we experienced this week with stage 6 load shedding?
Well, I don't know about the stage 6, but certainly we could have avoided stage 2, which was the 2 megawatts that we ended up needing in order to avoid stage 2.
Well, here's Jeff, who's just messaged us now to say, on load shedding, I'm in retail. We spend 6,000 Rand a day just to keep the shop open when there's load shedding. That's just one supermarket. Think of the total national diesel bill to keep the big retailer open. Then imagine who's paying. In the end, it is us, the consumer.
Yep.
Jeff, that's correct, right?
Mm-hmm.
How long do you think we can bear this? Because it does take, look, fortunately, and Praveen seems to think that this is a good thing rather than a bad thing. Fortunately, it's December, which means people are slowing down. There is less industry going on than in any other month of the year. And we're experiencing this nonetheless. Maintenance is a major problem. CADID deployment is the big ugly elephant in the room that no one wants to talk about. We have had, over the period of 25 years of democracy in this country, constantly a promotion of principles and of policies which have seen a number of people put into positions that aren't capable of running those positions. And we've seen a lot of competent people leaving the state-owned enterprises. Do you think the ANC acknowledges this part of the problem? Do you think in their deepest, darkest, secretest moments when they're sitting in that NEC and no one's listening, they actually acknowledge that this is a problem?
I certainly think that it's something that is giving Ramaphosa sleepless nights. Because if you think about this, his ability to maintain this very slender grip on power that he has is going to be dependent on actually having an electorate that's really happy with the way in which he's running the country. So I certainly think that cutting short his trip and coming back was not entirely pandering. I think it's out of a genuine sense of, if I don't get back, you know, this is really going to go to hell in a handbasket. And I think then drawing interpretation from that, is it likely that the likes of Ace are sitting on the sidelines and gleefully rubbing their hands in anticipation of a potential meltdown and needing to step in?
Well, surely Cyril's loss here is Ace's loss as well, because Ace is, if anything, touting the fact that government can do things, government can run things.
Yeah.
The ANC is a powerful organization that makes things happen. That's not the case. And anyone who's going to try and push an NHI or anything like that at the moment, Dumo, they're going to have a huge problem, right?
Yeah, they are.
Because the state has proven itself to be the worst manager.
But they're pushing ahead with it all the same.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
and expropriation without compensation.
What's happening there, by the way? Because we haven't had an update in a while.
Yeah, there was draft legislation that was tabled.
Now, I saw a bit of information going around on social media yesterday about that. Does that mean that they're sneaking this in over the December period because it's quiet?
Well, Parliament has shut down now for the rest of the year. So
no new laws?
Yeah, so no new laws, basically, between now and then.
Here's someone who says they work in the sugar industry. We have the ability to generate and export a lot of extra power at a lot less than Eskom charges. Eskom refuses to let us push power into the grid.
Yep, exactly what I've been saying.
There we go. So that's to back you up.
It's the whole license thing. Licenses are designed to keep people out, really.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, can we talk quickly about some of the other things that are going on? Because there's quite a lot to cover. The ANC on Wednesday said it would not exonerate itself from the load shedding crisis, but didn't really take on too much responsibility, as Canton's already pointed out. Here's something interesting, though, from the eThekwini municipality. 15 eThekwini municipal officials and contractors have been arrested for fraud and corruption. The Hawks say the suspects are linked to a waste collection tender fraud scheme, which paid out over $200 million. They will all face charges of fraud, corruption, and racketeering. The former eThekwini mayor, Zandile Gumede, was arrested earlier this year on similar charges. Now, is anything going to happen here?
Look, I think what's interesting is if you've been watching over the past couple of weeks, really, there have been this small but growing slew of arrests that have been taking place. And it's not yet actually nailing any big fish. But we're certainly talking about contracts in tens of millions and hundreds of millions where people have been slowly but surely getting arrested. And we had, Bongo was the first really big fish.
First minister.
Former minister to be indicted.
Right.
But remember a while back we were talking about when is the National Prosecution Authority actually going to get off its butt and start doing something.
Correct.
And I think if we start accumulating a list of people who've been arrested, you know, particularly since the start of December, I think we'll find that there's actually a bit of a pattern.
So this is good news in dribs and drabs.
Yeah, well, I'm being hopeful, of course.
Sure, but thank God, because we need a little bit of hopefulness.
Yes.
Well, Dudu Zanizuma tweeted out yesterday. He's been mostly quiet, but he had this to say. When Baba was still president, he gave the country his word and said we will never experience load shedding again. He kept his promise up until he was bullied into resignation by his own party that joined forces with right-wingers. Hashtag load shedding. And then someone replied to him, saying, if your dad was still president, we would be on load shedding stage 11-11. But there have been promises made. In fact, what we've got to remember about this whole Eskom situation, and it's quite disturbing that Cyril's first visit to, I think, Medupi or Kusile, was now, this year.
Yeah.
And he was charged with sorting this problem out in 2015 already as deputy president.
You know, I'll cut him some slack. I mean, you know, Medupi is, you guys
construction
know.
Construction site.
Yeah. No, but you know where it's located physically, right?
In Mpumalanga, right?
Yeah, but no, it's sort of in the far left corner of the upper part. It's close to the Botswana border.
Okay. Oh, so it's northwest.
I know
one of the big power stations, if not one of the new big power stations, either Kusile or Medupi, is in Mpumalanga, but the other one may well be in the northwest. Either way, so what, Canton? It's not that far.
Well,
people live there.
Yes, but one would have to drive over potholes in order to be able to get there. And
he'd figure out that the country needs some government.
Yeah, there you go. It's pretty much sitting right on the border.
Okay, so it's right up north, kind of Limpopo, mm-hmm. Northwest Province-ish. Yeah.
Which, then begs the
Ellis
question.
Ellis Russ area.
Yeah, Ellis Russ, that's exactly right. And which then begs the question, why exactly did we end up putting a power station up there?
Well, isn't it because we need certain things geographically for a power station to work properly, like water?
Yes. One does need water, but
Limpopo River's right there.
No. Limpopo River is quite far away from there. Although what I do see is that there's Exxaro Coal has there's a fuel supply, but of course under the Guptas, what happened was Exxaro was tossed out, and then the Gupta mines were brought in at a higher cost.
And we paid in advance for that and never got a single piece of coal, did we?
Absolutely right. Yep. Yeah. But fortunately, I offloaded my Exxaro shares because I saw that coming.
Oh.
So I sold at a profit.
Yeah. Smart. Mm. Do you think that they still have a chance now that they're back in the supply chain of improving their
economic
standing?
I don't think so. And it's really got nothing to do with their economic standing. It's just that the numbers right now in terms of new coal make no sense whatsoever.
Okay.
So if you drill down to Medupi, and remember what I said about resetting it so that we can get a real sense of what Medupi is worth. I don't believe that Medupi, even if you wipe out its debt completely, will be able to produce electricity at a cost per megawatt that is going to be at a level that is lower than new wind or new solar.
Hmm.
And I'm very specifically talking about new wind and new solar. Ultimately, if we want long-term power capability, we have to go nuclear.
Yeah. Right.
Agreed.
Absolutely have to go nuclear. But obviously it has to be nuclear that's not on the same terms as Putin wants us to have it.
Yeah. And there are ways to do that.
Well, we've done it before. Correct. We built Kuburg. And surely we just resurrect those plans and duplicate Kuburg. Loose bolts notwithstanding.
There are, before we completely leave politics on the local front alone, there are two things that have happened that are quite bad for the DA on the face of it. History will not be kind to them over the last week because they've lost Joburg and they've lost Tshwane. The DA was on the ascendant for a long time in terms of municipal politics. They had fractious coalition governments with the EFF in those two cities, those two major metros. But the ANC has wrested control back into their own hands in both. This is surely bad news for the DA and good news for the ANC, something worth celebrating for the ANC?
Maybe.
No?
I think so. I think what the DA did, the mistake that they made at the beginning was actually forming a coalition with the devil, which was the EFF, because it always put them in a position where they were going to, if the EFF felt that the DA was not good enough, they just side with the ANC. So I think from the beginning, the ANC was always had an advantage because of the fact that all they just need to do is just woo the EFF because they have similar philosophies and stuff like that. So I think, it's good for the ANC and also good for the DA as well. They can just probably rework their strategies on how they're going to win the next municipal election if they have a chance.
But they don't. This is serious smash to their confidence. And I think the electorate are looking at this going, well, why did we waste our time?
You might remember a couple of weeks ago when Steenhuisen was appointed.
Yes.
And I immediately said that's a bad move.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because I think that he lacks the gravitas to actually take this thing forward. He, immediately started bleating about the need for redress, which I think is exactly the message that DA voters don't want to be hearing at this point.
Yeah.
So I think that you're going to see an ongoing move in the direction of people like the Vryheids Front Plus.
Oh, really? That's where it's going to go?
Well, in the short term.
It already has in the last elections.
It already has in the last elections. And it's certainly been the case in terms of by-elections as well.
Right.
And if you consider that in the Western Cape, which is the DA's stronghold, because of the fact that you've had Patricia de Lille's good party now also contesting those elections.
Yes.
Effectively, she's been splitting the vote that would formerly have been guaranteed to the DA, which means that a lot of seats have actually been lost to the ANC just simply because the vote has been split between Good and the DA.
Mm.
And again, that goes back to the whole question of the manner in which the DA ousted Patricia de Lille in the first place.
Correct. Very bad move on their part there. I think everyone agrees.
Yes.
And certainly they're paying the price now. Among other things, that was a bad decision. There were a number of other bad decisions that put them in this position.
Well, the thing that we've said so many times in the past, that if the DA had continued their growth trajectory, which was started by Tony Leon and then continued by Helen Ziller, if they had kept up a steady 8% growth every year, they would need to get to around about 2030 before they'd be in a position to govern. And so really this rush to try and get to a point where they're able to govern in places like Johannesburg and Pretoria, I think was just stupid, because they were not able to do any of the things that the DA is good at. And they didn't do any of the things that they had actually promised to do. I mean, I'm still looking for Mashaba's inner city development. Now, if you go down to Maboneng, which under an ANC government was actually one of the safest places in Johannesburg, and now you're actually having armed robberies right in the heart of Maboneng.
Mm.
And people are not talking about this stuff, but it is actually happening.
Well, thank goodness you're talking about it. I want you to talk about something else, if you don't mind. Turn your attention to this. The South African Labour and Development Research Unit has published some kind of a tool which tells you how your monthly income compares with the rest of the country. Now, this is always interesting, especially to people who are obsessed with the Gini coefficient or obsessed with equality. But it's also interesting to people who want to look at the tax base. Do you know that according to the data, to be among the richest 1% of South Africans, you only need to earn a household income, household, that means you and your wife together, of 48,753 rand per month after tax. Now, that is a lot of money, but to be in the 1% in South Africa, the richest 10% take home 7,313 rand a month. That's the richest 10% in the country. It's not a lot of money. Mm. This is a very, very thin crust of the upper crust. It's not necessarily indicative of a very strong tax base or a very strong system on which government can derive some kind of meaningful income tax on, right? I mean,
shall I trot out numbers again?
Yeah, go on.
Okay. 58 million people in the country.
Yeah.
All right. 14 million people who are in formal employment out of that 58 million. Out of that 14 million, 6.5 million pay no income tax. So there are 7.5 million people who pay our income tax bill, which is roughly 522 billion rand a year. It's the single biggest contributor
to tax,
to the budget.
Yeah.
Out of that 7.5 million people who pay taxes, half of that 500-odd billion comes from 7 million people. The other half comes from 500,000 people.
Hmm.
So, you know, everyone who's been talking for the longest time about the need for a wealth tax. No, actually, the wealth tax is already there. Because of the progressive tax structure, the wealthiest people in this country are actually keeping this country afloat. It's the single biggest injection into the budget from any group. So that's more than a quarter of a trillion rand that goes into the national budget that comes from just 500,000 people. And those are the 500,000 people who are migrating.
And those are the 500,000 people the government should also take some trouble to look after occasionally, because otherwise they're going to leave, or they're going to stop paying, or both.
Yeah.
Well, they just keep snot-clapping them and telling them how terrible they are and how they need to be doing more.
Sorry.
But consider this, 14 million people employed and 17 million people on life support, which is welfare.
Hmm. Yeah, just to continue on Canton's point, just going back to those categories that are used by, I mean, those statistics that you mentioned, like the lowest point to enter into the top 1% is about 45,000. 48,000. So I think, you know, going back to your point on also creating a good tax base that could actually, you know, get some decent income for the government, I think that we shouldn't really look at abstract categories like that. I think we should look at, like, how many people can actually pay tax. And what's worrying is that, like, I mean, out of those, what, 14 million people that are working, only like 5 million of them are actually paying tax. How's that possible? You know, we need to actually increase that tax base somehow. And I think the more people we can get into work, the more people can get taxed, the more the larger the tax revenue as well.
Well, look, the logic around that, the people who are not, basically, if you earn 6,500 a month or less, you don't pay income tax.
Yeah.
And there's a progressive scale that kind of moves up so that when you get to the upper end of it, you know, effectively, you know, those of us in the top end of the tax bracket, if we get a 100 rand pay increase, effectively close to 50 rand of that goes back to the government in terms of tax. And I don't really have a problem with that. But my logic also said that one of the quickest ways in which you actually fix things right now is you take those 7 million people who are currently providing roughly about a quarter of a trillion towards the tax base, and just give that tax base a massive tax cut.
Yeah.
And just let them then inject that money back into the economy, because we need stimulus right now.
Yeah,
it's agreed. The only thing that's going to really claw us out of it. That is the group of people where if you allow them to more money to be able to spend, what are the things they're going to spend it on? They're going to upgrade their cars. They're going to upgrade their TV sets. They're going to spend money on home improvements, yeah. All of which filters back into the economy directly.
Right.
Yeah, the 500,000 who pay the biggest price, no, they don't need a tax cut because they're not going to spend the money if they're given a tax cut. They'll, you know, just invest it. Well,
Or send more of it overseas.
We've had this discussion before, right, where I said if you suddenly gave me R1 million, I wouldn't know what to do with it because, you know, what would I spend it on? I don't need it. I'm happy with my old car. I'm happy with my old house. But I'm not the target market.
Can we turn our attention quickly to Britain? They're having an election today. The UK is going to the polls, and obviously there's a choice here, a stark choice between Jeremy Corbyn and Boris Johnson. It is a parliamentary election because the Prime Minister is the leader of the biggest party in Parliament. There are 650 different constituencies all going to vote today. What do we assume the results will mean if they go one way or the other? And how significant is this vote? It's the umpteenth poll that Britain has been forced to go and vote on. This one is an election. It will give either to Boris Johnson a mandate of some import, or it will smack the Tories out of existence. I mean, what are the options here? And where do parties like the Liberal Democrats and the Brexit Party reside in this new milieu?
Okay.
Tossing this ball in Duma's
direction. Okay, cool. For me, the way I see it, it's a Brexit thing, really.
Yes.
I don't follow UK politics that much, but what I can get from it is that it seems in this election, it seems that Johnson needs like some sort of majority in order to fulfill the mandate of Brexit. And if he wins, but he doesn't get a landslide victory, then, you know, they're going to... What's that word they use? The mandate. Parliament will be...
Dissolved.
Well, not dissolved.
Prorogued.
It'll be a hung parliament.
Yeah, hung parliament. Yes. That's the one, hung.
Okay.
So because now it's going to be hung, that's also just going to be delayed. The Brexit will be delayed. I mean, we've seen already. I mean, the public voted and, you know, there was votes after another vote, after another vote. And, you know, Jeremy Corbyn and his guys are also delaying the whole thing. So I just think for me, this is just like the ultimate, really. If Boris Johnson wins, then I can see Brexit happening. But Brexit has been really the main, for me, the main driver of these
elections.
Boris
is looking for a mandate for Brexit here. That's what he's looking for.
Yes. And
do you think he's likely to get it?
Look,
come on, play prediction here, gentlemen.
I'm playing okay. Prediction. And here's my harebrained prediction. I think that Boris is going to get a convincing mandate.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, he'll get a majority. But Boris might lose his own seat.
How so? Because he's threatened in his own constituency?
He's threatened in his own constituency.
Where is he?
Some
rural backwater?
No. It's one of the London suburbs.
Right. Chelsea but, or Knightsbridge,
yeah,
probably.
But, you know, some people who've been crunching the numbers.
Now, what does that mean? Because if he loses his seat, he can't be elected to Parliament, which means he can't be elected Prime Minister.
Exactly, yes.
It's
an interesting...
Wow.
Yes.
Sure.
Uh-huh. That would be a strange outcome.
Yes, it would be a very strange outcome indeed.
What of these Remainers who are saying that democracy has been thwarted and actually this is not democratic and they don't like the idea of people being given a second chance to vote?
I think the Remainers have pretty much run out of steam at this point. There's been a sustained campaign over the past, 3 years since Brexit was passed by that referendum. And they've been doing their damnedest to push the entire, well, it's effectively a globalization agenda.
Right.
Which has essentially been driven mainly by rich people.
Yeah.
You know, who love the ease of being able to hop back and forth across to Europe, to have properties on the Côte d'Azur, you know, go skiing in the Alps whenever they choose to and have a holiday home up there as well. And whereas for Joe Bloggs, who's sitting in London and suddenly discovers that he actually cannot afford to live in London anymore because of the fact that you have wealthy people from the rest of Europe who've actually been acquiring property in the middle of London.
Yeah.
And so you've had London spreading farther and farther outwards. But, you know, fortunately, they've had fairly drastic improvements in their public transport system in order to cope with that. But basically what it means is that if you happen to be, let's say, an Uber driver in London, well, maybe that's a bad example because London's now shut down Uber as of last week. But certainly the Uber drivers that I spoke to when I was in London last time, which was, about a year ago, I guess, and they were basically making the point that they can't afford to live in the city.
Yeah.
So they live far out beyond Heathrow, and they basically then travel into town to work every day and then head back at night.
And have to pay congestion charges and all kinds of other things,
all of that kind of stuff.
If Boris doesn't get his mandate, what does that mean? What happens?
If Boris doesn't get its mandate, we're pretty much exactly where we've been for the past 3 years. So,
in stasis.
Yeah, in stasis. Jeremy Corbyn wants to have another referendum. I doubt that the...
But this is kind of a referendum.
Yeah.
What more does he want?
I really think so. Look, all indications are based on the numbers, and if you read past the spin, on average, the Conservatives have been tracking at a 10 percentage point lead over Labour.
And what about the Liberal Democrats? What about the Brexit Party?
They're kind of minuscule in the
They don't really matter.
They don't really matter. And look, the Brexit Party guys have already said...
They're with the Conservatives.
Well, they're not contesting any of the seats that were considered to be safe seats for the Conservatives.
Okay. All right. But they will still go after seats.
They are still going after seats. Exactly.
Okay. Well, we're in...
But the Lib Dems are very clearly opposed... To Brexit, yes. So the only two clear messages that you've got in this election are from the Conservatives, who are saying, get Brexit done.
Yeah.
And from the Lib Dems, who say, no, we want to remain. And if you vote for us, then that's going to be our agenda.
Okay. And what does this have to do with South Africans who could travel to the UK without needing a visa once upon a time? Because back in 2009, that was the case.
That was the case. Look, the reason why we lost that is because we had corruption at Home Affairs.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it wasn't because of fake passports. It's just that you could legally buy real passports. The Guptas are a case in point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just brought all of these workers in who were then promptly given authentic Home Affairs documents. And so it became a security hazard for the UK because, you know, the easiest way to then basically import terror into the UK is send people down from Al-Qaeda or ISIS to Johannesburg, get them to buy a legal passport from Home Affairs,
right,
and then hop across to the UK. There was that white widow woman.
She was resident in Kenya for some time.
Yes, and then legally acquired a South African passport out here, and there you go.
But of course, for South Africans who want to travel to the UK, this has become a problem. How exactly does the EU and its rules factor into perhaps young South Africans who want to go and work in the UK for a little bit?
Yeah, well, that particular package, which it was a youth work visa, which basically meant that if you were between 18 and 30, you could go and work in the UK for 2 years.
Okay.
And it was a fantastic program. I know lots of people who went through that program. And you know, working in a place like London, I always tell people London's really the closest thing we have to a planetary capital.
Yeah.
And you work in that environment, and this is melting pot of all of humanity. And it just changes your perspective, and you come back home and you're a better person just simply because your expectations have shifted.
But the EU made it very difficult for
the EU made that difficult. And then, of course, there was the fact that, again, they couldn't trust that the youngsters coming from South Africa
were not terrorists. But Canton, if Brexit happens, will that improve this situation for people who might want to go and work in London?
I think it's going to improve the situation for skilled professionals.
Okay.
So
if you work for a bank or you work as in law or something like that, you
absolutely
might want to go and practice.
If you're an actuary and stuff like that. I have in my immediate family quite a few people who happen to have scarce skills, and they've hopped across to the UK and they're doing extremely well. They're working in technology, they're working in medicine.
But they are going to live there now.
Yes, yes.
Whereas before, they could go over there, get some experience, and come back and bring it here.
Well, that was when you were a kid. But now I'm talking about older seasoned professionals. Right. Because Boris is wanting to shift the migration policy of the UK, which, you know, again, right now they've got open borders with the rest of Europe. So what that means is that people from the rest of Europe have been flocking across to London.
Yeah.
Just, you know, simply because, I mean, if you happen to be an unemployed person in Poland, you can come across to London and work as a domestic worker.
Yeah.
And earn extremely high wages by the standards of your home country. And guess what? You can still apply to afford to fly home at weekends because of the likes of Ryanair and EasyJet, you know, because if you book far enough in advance, you can get tickets for as little as £25.
Evil capitalism.
Yeah, I know, evil capitalism.
All right, let's turn our attention to America.
Ooh, yes.
Because America is exciting at the moment. How's impeachment going? How's that going for the Democrats in Congress at the moment?
Well, there's been a lot of hot air.
Yeah. And not a lot of evidence. Not a lot of first-hand evidence.
Yes.
But just any kind that counts.
Yeah, the interesting thing is that it's going to go to debate in the Senate. And the Senate will kind of yawn. And they'll never get the two-thirds majority in Senate
Could
to pass it.
Could Donald Trump be the first president to be impeached by Congress for that trial to go ahead and for him not to be put to not be convicted by trial in the Senate, and then go on and win an overwhelming victory in the elections next year?
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that would be a real failure by the Democrats.
Well, the Democrats are already failures.
But you can hear that they're planning to lose the election and to set up a separate narrative, this narrative being, as I understand it, because this is what they're trotting out now, we're so divided, the country's not great, America's never been worse off, we need to go back to normalcy, and here's Joe Biden. Joe, good old Joe from the old Obama era, remember him? He's stable. He's not dangerous like Trump. He's not dividing us like Trump. Trump's an unstable genius. He said so himself.
Except you've got Bernie Sanders.
Stable genius.
Right. And Bernie Sanders actually has been polling relatively high in the numbers, especially now that Kamala Harris is out of the race.
But this is because the Democratic Party's gone so far left. And people are saying Michael Bloomberg only came into the race to try and draw them back to the center.
Yeah, that's going to be an interesting one. And we don't have a sense yet of how Michael Bloomberg's numbers are going to start looking.
But Bernie, you bring up Bernie. So Bernie was really cheated by Hillary Clinton in the last election.
Yes, he was.
And that there was some skullduggery, the kind of skullduggery they're accusing Trump of in the Russia hoax and now in this Ukraine impeachment drive.
Well, it was precisely the leaking of those emails that
from the DNC.
Yes, that started this entire mess in the first place.
So Bernie was cheated, but this time his numbers are looking promising, you say?
His numbers are looking promising. He's not polling too far behind Biden. Biden's still the front runner, but not by a significant margin.
And Pocahontas? Elizabeth Warren?
Oh, yeah, I remember. I think she's still in the race somewhere.
So now that Kamala's dropped out, do you think Bernie's picked up a lot of her votes?
Potentially.
And well, Pete Buttigieg, who's been for a little while the darling of the media, and now they're starting to lose.
Look, Bernie's been making promises that, you know, he thinks it's wrong, for example, that people incur medical debt by going to have babies in hospital. And, you know, there might be some merit in that at some level. But the truth is that it applies to those who end up not being on healthcare.
Yeah.
And what is true is that the number of people who are actually on healthcare is at a higher level than it ever has been previously. But more to the point, the number of people that Bernie could potentially be looking at pulling on board as his support base, black voters, Hispanic voters, people who've been marginalized from an economic point of view, Trump has actually been mopping up that audience.
Yeah. going back to the impeachment, Lindsey Graham was saying that it'll actually be beneficial if the Democrats actually drag this this whole impeachment trial, as opposed to it just getting the vote done and then going to Senate immediately. And I think that'll work because, you know, these guys have failed with the whole Russia hoax and everything like that. And I just think this impeachment is just another way for these guys to win.
Well, they can't win the election outright. They're admitting as much themselves. Mm-hmm. But they're saying that Donald Trump is an existential threat to the United States. Basically, the last three Republican presidents, the last two, Donald Trump and George W. Bush, the Democrats said these were illegitimate presidents anyway. They were questioning the legitimacy, first of all, of the electoral system in terms of the Electoral College. Mm-hmm. And they also obviously had a problem with the popular vote with Al Gore and George W. Bush all those years ago, too. So they're lining this up to be about Trump, even if he wins, being an illegitimate president, right?
Yeah, they are. But I just don't think the American public is that dumb enough to believe that, to be honest. The numbers are there. They voted for him. He won. You know, how can you say it's illegitimate? I don't see how they...
Every day since then, they've been saying... Nancy Pelosi herself the other day called him an imposter.
Yeah, it's...
She used the term imposter for the president.
No, I just... At the end of the day, I just think they're trying to create a narrative and using any small situation and actually using it as some sort of mileage to make irresponsible statements at the end of the day. Because I don't really think... That who, Trump has done anything.
Who is the Democrats' best bet at the moment? Isn't it Joe Biden? I mean, he's a centrist. Compared with the rest of his party.
Yeah. It was Joe Biden immediately after Obama's departure.
Right.
But Biden didn't stand for election at that time. Remember that he had a death in his family. He lost his son.
Right. That's
And so... he was basically recovering from that, and so he stepped out of the race, and then of course Saint Hillary stepped into the breach, and
she's still running around shouting and screaming. She hasn't completely absented herself from the political scene.
Yes, although Epstein.
What? Well, she means she was involved? Come on. That's not starting
not
conspiracy
at all.
Theories.
Here, let me show you a tweet from Boris Johnson.
Okay. Oh.
Okay.
What is this? He says, "Vanakkam, I want to thank the Tamil community for everything."
Yeah, so it seems that he's trying to entice my fellow Tamilians to end up voting.
All right, well, thank you, gentlemen. That's all we got time for this morning in the Burning Platform. It's brought to you by Nando's every week. Spicy hot sometimes. Sometimes it's very hot. Sometimes it's mild. Sometimes it's lemon and herb. You never know what you're going to get.
Couple of thoughts
You've got something on your mind, Catherine?
Yeah, a couple of thoughts to leave people with. There have been two significant court judgments over the recent past. The one is the free speech judgment in favor of John Guelani, where... he had
said, remind us what that was about.
He had written an article in 2008 saying, "Call me anything but gay, but not gay."
And homophobic case.
And the Supreme Court then came out with what I think was a very well written and very considered judgment that actually errs on the side of freedom of speech.
What is that?
And it basically says that the litmus test for hate speech should not be whether it's hurtful, but whether it is actually harmful. And it's an important distinction.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because suddenly, and the court makes the point that hate speech cannot be defined by feelings, because feelings inherently are subjective.
So that's a very big deal.
It's a powerful judgment. And I urge people who have the time, it's a 48-page judgment.
Okay.
By Judge Mohammed Solomon Nafsa, writing the majority opinion for. Well, it was a unanimous opinion for a full bench of the appellate division. It will now go to the Supreme Court. It will now go to the Constitutional Court for ratification. But effectively, it struck out portions of the law that deal with hate. Interesting thing for me is how this then gets retrofitted to things like Penny Sparrow. And so I'm waiting for the legal challenges to actually emerge around that.
The other judgment?
The other judgment was in the Constitutional Court, and that happened either yesterday or the day before. But it was with regard to a rape case. And it's the question of whether you get prosecuted as an accomplice, as an accomplice or accessory, or you get prosecuted as a perpetrator. And in this particular case, this was a horrendous gang rape scenario, where there were a couple of people who stood around and watched while the rapists actually did the deed. But the people who stood around and watched were prosecuted as rapists themselves, because they basically cheered on the people who were committing the crime. And they had applied to the Constitutional Court saying that the means test was unfair. And the Constitutional Court gave them a solid smackdown and said, no, absolutely not. You guys are perpetrators in the grand scheme of things.
So that means that if you stand around and you watch a rape happen, you are an accessory to that rape.
Yes, well, in this context, yeah, there are consequences that go with it. And so I think that these are two very positive things that have emerged from our courts in the space of a week. And if we're looking for good news, I think that's a good point to end it on.
All right, very good. So free speech and ugly crimes against women both being treated differently by our courts, but both of these are positive judgments in your opinion. Thank you very much, Canton. Dumo Denga, very nice to see you, sir.
Thanks
for popping by. And thank you for joining us. If you'd like to join in the Burning Platform, if you'd like to suggest anything that you'd like us to cover, then please email us, gareth@cliffcentral.com. And thanks again to Nando's, who really are the bravest people in the business when it comes to standing behind all kinds of political commentary and doing it with a sense of humor. CliffCentral.com.